Welcome to a special extended edition of Minnesota Native News. I'm Marie Rock. This is the second in a two-part series about the small city of Bemidji and the work people there are doing to show that Native lives matter. Bemidji is a city of about 15,000 in Minnesota's Northwoods. Native Americans, mostly Ojibwe or Anishinaabe, make up about 50% of the population in the metro region. The town is near the border of three of the largest, most populous Indian reservations in the state, the Red Lake Nation on the north, the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe to the east, and the White Earth Nation is to the southwest. Over the past 50 years, Natives and non-Natives have been finding ways to make American Indians here less romanticized and less demonized. And yet, deep racial disparities persist in hospitals, in schools, and in jails. In this half hour, we'll hear about a new movement that's building now. It's focused on telling truths about the past to change minds and eventually the institutions that maintain these racial inequities. Here's reporter Melissa Townsend.
Let me introduce you to John Gonzalez. He's a psychology professor at Bemidji State University. He basically studies prejudice and discrimination and their impacts on Native people. He himself is Ojibwe. He's a citizen of the White Earth Nation, and he lives in Bemidji.
Certainly, you know, there's lots of stories of the overt, the old-fashioned racism where, you know, people have open aggression and hostility towards, you know, Native people.
Like what Anton Troyer experienced 35 years ago in his middle school in Bemidji.
Where there were four kids sitting around a quad table in the shop class, and I was the only Native at our table. And the kids started in, "Indians are all drunks. Yeah, they're just leeches on the government. Yeah, they're running us dry." And I'd say, "No, that's not true. My mom said," and they'd cut me off. "Your mom just said that because she's a dumb squat," and they just keep going.
Nowadays, for the most part, that type of racism is unacceptable in society, right? You know, there's still a few of those folks out there, right? But for most people, are good, decent people.
Like Kathleen McKinstra at the recent Bay Majigamog powwow.
The colors, the chanting, the drums. And I realize when I come to an event like this how ignorant I am and how much I have yet to learn. And it's time to get going on that. So
most people are good, decent people.
You hear the butt coming, right?
But here's the paradox, right? We were raised, you know, to believe in equality, to treat people how you want to be treated, right? So if that's true, then how come we have such inequality in society? How do those two things go together?
Professor John Gonzalez says good and decent people act in oppressive and racist ways without necessarily knowing it.
We have this unfortunate, terrible history around race in our country. Every single one of us have inherited that. Right. And we're taught every single day, unconsciously even, the stereotypes for every single group. And all the research shows that if a stereotype exists about a group, unconsciously, we act upon those stereotypes outside of our own awareness.
So those painful stereotypes are at work everywhere, all the time. In this half hour, we hear about three different efforts to take on the stereotypes, to offer a different narrative, and to begin a process of change. Talking with people for this story, I often asked American Indians about any personal experiences that they have had with racism. I heard about things that happened in schools, in stores, on streets. And then I asked Renee Gurneau,
"Did you have experiences of racism in Bemidji as a young person?"
What? Some people think that racism is a personally bad attitude. It's not. What it is pervasive, and it's institutionalized, and it's part of every aspect of American life. And Native people are on the receiving end of that inequity more than any other group. So it is systemic and pervasive in all of Bemidji life.
And Renee refuses to play her apportioned role in this system.
I am always, always, always clear that wherever I am, I'm standing in the position of being the indigenous person of this land, and that other people are guests in my house. I am not a guest in theirs.
Renee's a community educator, and she and I sat down together just after she wrapped a four-day training. We're in an empty room at the Y in Grand Rapids. That's another border town about an hour southwest of Bemidji. Her training is called the Anishinaabe Worldview. It's a class she offers community groups. This Grand Rapids class was all white and included two police officers, a few counselors, and a legal aid attorney. In the class, she talks about traditional ways of the Anishinaabe. That's sustainable hunting and gathering, some of the community customs, and a bit about the spirituality that connects them to their ancestors and the land. She says she offers people the history lesson they never learned in school, the things they never heard about, and the things they might have heard, but not from a native perspective.
You know, the colonization of this land, you know, is coached in these real glorious open land for settlement kind of terms. And that's certainly not how we experienced it. You know, we experienced it as an invasion and a genocide and a Holocaust that was beyond belief.
And this leads to what seems like the crux of the whole four-day training. Before white colonization, Renee says there were no crises in Native communities. That is, there were no problems with addiction, violence, abandonment, disease.
Poverty and suicide and, you know, dropout and all of that kind of talk is presented as though those problems originate from within the community when in fact they are responses to oppression.
Renee and many others believe the high rates of addiction, violence, and disease in Native communities are the byproducts of the trauma Native people experienced trying to survive a genocide that lasted generations.
If you were to go into the county jail, Beltrami County Jail, who would you see there as Native people? You go into the detention at a high school, and who you see is our young people there.
And without a complete, truthful understanding of American history, you might think Native people are just troubled or somehow predisposed to dysfunction. Boom, stereotype confirmed.
There needs to be a deeper understanding of the historical trauma. What does that mean exactly? And we're finding out more and more what that means all the time. But right now in the U.S., it's just the very, very, very beginnings of that conversation.
Through her trainings, Renee Gourneau is doing her part to get more people talking about historical trauma. After Renee took off, I stuck around and met with some of the people who had been in her training. Now, it's possible some folks didn't like this training and they left without talking to me. But the people who stayed said it was pretty profound.
My name's Scott Johnson. I'm the police chief in Grand Rapids.
Scott Johnson said the training was an eye-opener.
In the United States, we form policy that we think is best for people. Sometimes it's, you know, let's hope most of the time, it's meant to further these people, to benefit these people. But I think what we realize now is when it comes to the Native American population, it's done a lot of harm. And this generation may not be responsible for making those policies, but we are responsible for doing the best we can to write those policies.
Others had very specific ideas about what they want to do differently now.
Lynn Cochran, North and Counseling Center Residential Services.
Lynn Cochran is white. She works as a mental health counselor and crisis support contact in Itasca County. That's just next to Bemidji's Beltrami County. During the training, Lynn says she kept remembering an encounter she had with a Native teen a few years back.
Who came in with her grandma, and she had had some suicidal behavior at school, some suicidal talk, and so they brought her in to the ER in Deer River. The grandmother was trying to help me understand why they didn't want to do the plan that I was offering of let's look at getting her some medication possibly, let's look at what kind of therapy we could do in the school. This girl was having visions that I, at the time, thought were hallucinations. Grandma felt that they're spiritual beings that were trying to speak to her and give her teachings and whatnot. So, and I didn't get that at all at the time, but I feel like now I do get that, and I probably would have the direction to send them in the right direction.
Like what would you do differently?
Well, I would suggest more tribal resources, more ceremonial life, more focus on getting in connect with an elder from the tribe, or, you know, asking them about who their family connections are and where they're from.
That's huge.
Yeah.
That's a huge shift.
Right. We're so trained to look for the directory. We're so trained to look for the written plan and have, okay, on this day we're going to do this, and then the next thing we're going to do this, and it's very compartmentalized like that. And that's not how Native culture works. And so they don't mesh very well.
When you had this training, This is really a personal question. And then you look back at that example. Do you feel bad?
We talked about white guilt in our training. And what did she say?
She doesn't believe it.
You don't have to have white guilt. You're just busted. So it's kind of like just realizing, oh, well, that's what happened. You know, so it's more of a just a realization and an understanding for me rather than necessarily feeling badly about it. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think that I could have done anything differently at that time. I just didn't have the tools.
Social worker Lynn Cochran learned something new about the Anishinaabe experience, and it changed her perspective in a fundamental way. Sometimes things don't go this smoothly. Sometimes there's, well, let's say, resistance to hearing the Anishinaabe side of the colonization story.
Paul's a great big guy, sticks his head up through the sky.
Bemidji's most famous landmark is a giant statue of the mythological lumberjack Paul Bunyan and his companion, Babe the Blue Ox. Paul stands 18 feet high and weighs 2.5 tons. And this June, Paul and Babe are getting a new neighbor. There will be a new bronze statue of Chief Bemidji. He is obviously the namesake of the town. He was a respected Native American leader who lived here during the timber boom in the late 1800s. His Ojibwe name is Shenawishkong.
That's the dichotomy of America, isn't it? From a fairy tale to reality.
Jody Bolio is a Native woman from Red Lake. You might remember her from the first part of this series. For the past few years, she's been on the Chief Bemidji Statue Committee, the group that's driven this whole project. So when you go to visit Paul and Babe, you can pick up a paper pamphlet that has stories about their, well, quote-unquote, life and times in the area. The plan for the new Chief Bemidji statue doesn't include a paper pamphlet. Instead, the statue will have 4 bronze plaques with information about his life and times. The proposed information on those 4 plaques is, well, different from what you'll get from Paul. Here's what I mean.
Paul Bunyan, legendary Superman and woodsman, hero of the early logging days.
The utmost good faith shall always be observed toward the Indians. Their lands and property shall never be taken from them without their consent.
Northern Minnesota was the center of his mighty exploits, and this area was Paul's playground.
And the land dwindled down from 138 million acres in 1887 to 48 million acres in 1934.
No feat of strength or courage was beyond Paul's power. No obstacle stumped him.
Plaque 3 is tragedy and survival. People were forced to go over hundreds of miles away to get their annuities that they had coming for the land that they gave up. Quite a few of them died along the way, and so we have that in here.
To Jody Bolio and the whole Shenawishkong Statue Committee, this piece of art is an opportunity to give an honest telling of the Anishinaabe experience in this region. But in order to include any of this on the 4 bronze plaques, Jody and the committee need to get the approval of the 7-member all-white city council. Jody knew it wouldn't be an easy task, which seemed to make her only more determined.
You have this fictitious Paul Bunyan and the Blue Ox, and how long has that been going on? And yet we're trying to deal with someone who the city is named after, and you have problems with what we're trying to put on the plaques? Isn't it time to get real? Isn't it time to come out of the fairy tale?
We're going to go on to our next item on our agenda, which is consider the plaque language for the Chief Bemidji statue.
On April 20th, the Bemidji City Council met to vote on the information surrounding the new bronze statue of Chief Bemidji, Shenawishkong.
I view it as quite a deviation from the intent that we originally had when we funded the project.
Councilmember Roger Helquist said he thought it would be more of a celebration of the Indian heritage in the area.
I didn't really look at it to be a history lesson. I mean, I'm well aware of what atrocities were done and have read a number of different books on it. It's just that I didn't think this was the place for it.
They were all fine with the basic information about its birth, death, life as a peacemaker, negotiating with reps from the railroad and the timber industries. But some didn't like the information about broken treaties, stolen land, the War of 1862. Council member Nancy Erickson especially didn't like including the famous quote from Andrew Myrick about American Indians that says, So far as I'm concerned, if they're hungry, let them eat grass or their own dung.
That statement is an insult. It's an insult to the white population, and certainly it holds no value whatsoever, that statement. That is the core of where I am coming from when I am talking about these plaques.
Merrick was a white businessman in Minnesota involved in the conflict over supplies that led to the War of 1862. He was killed in that war.
This is what happened 150 years ago and should be buried. Should be buried along with the man. Those words hold no value. They do no uplifting. Nothing.
The Statue Committee's research shows Shana Wishkong persuaded Ojibwe people not to join the Dakota in the war. Mitch Blessing, who is not Native, is on the Shana Wishkong Statue Committee. He stood at a podium looking up at the 7-member council seated at their raised bench, and he made his case for including all of the proposed information.
My daughter's 7 years old now, and she's reading books now by herself, and she'd be one of those kids that's going to read that plaque. And I wanted you to know that from a very heartfelt place, I am concerned about fear and about bad things that have happened and saying things that are painful. And I also believe that the things that I've learned with my daughter and that she's learned from me have been from the hard questions. Daddy, why has that happened? Why did somebody say that bad thing? Why did somebody kill that person? And I've had to learn how to communicate to her, you know, those facts. And truth.
Mayor Rita Albright said all the information on the plaque should be approved.
We have tried for many years to sanitize history and to ignore history and to not really be truth tellers. And here's our opportunity to be brave, as Councilmember Olson said, and be courageous, and to acknowledge the fact that we have a history that we're not proud of.
Councilmember Mealhouse was also in favor of the plaques.
I think this, all four of these plaques really speak to, despite all the challenges he faced in his life, they speak to the person he became.
Thank you.
Toward the end of the debate, Jody Bolio says she felt like it was too close to call, so she got up to make one more final passionate plea. Be brave, she said.
Please, be brave. We've been brave alone for far too long. Miigwech.
Thank you. So, we have before us a motion to approve the recommendation from the Plaque Committee or the Chief Bemidji Committee. Roll call, please.
Johnson?
No.
Olson?
Yes.
Erickson?
No.
Albright?
Yes.
Larson?
Yes.
Mealhouse?
Yes.
Hellquist?
No.
Motion carries.
Thank you. Thank you for your hard work. Thank you.
And with that, it passed. The four plaques that accompany the new Chief Bemidji bronze statue will tell the story of Shana Wishkong, how he built relationships and negotiated with white businessmen and his own Anishinaabe people as their annuities were cut, their land was taken, and they were moved to reservations.
Well, when I walked out of there, I was just like in a celebratory mood, and I started singing because I felt so elated. So I started singing, "It's Been a Long Time Coming."
It's a long, 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 long time before the dawn.
Councilmember Nancy Erickson declined an interview request to talk about the plaques and the council's vote. In an email, she wrote, "As soon as the council votes on any issue before it, the matter is settled, and we accept the majority rule."
Here, you must hear what the people say.
After a hard-won victory comes a sobering reminder.
People can get behind a feel-good moment. It's easier to go clap at a statue commemoration, and I'll be there clapping too. And I do feel that that has meaning. But what's harder is then sustaining that into a deeper and more meaningful change.
Anton Troyer, director of the American Indian Resource Center at Bemidji State, is leading a new effort to do just that. It's called the Truth and Reconciliation Effort, and Anton says the group has been meeting since the beginning of 2014, and about 150 people have been involved. The group wants to engage leaders in education, law enforcement, and social service systems to get them to recognize the impact of the history of this place and to change their systems so that they work better for Native people.
Anton says it's tough.
Nobody wants to get beat up for the sins of their ancestors. And it's kind of hard to see the things that are not overt racism. The overt things, those are easy to see. But how a whole web of smaller privileges and practices really serve to marginalize Native people, it's harder to see.
I met up with a small group of people involved in the Truth and Reconciliation effort. We're meeting in a nondescript room at the American Indian Resource Center at Bemidji State. You probably know the kind. Linoleum floors, fluorescent lights, a few fold-out tables and chairs. I'm late to this meeting, and the group has been passing the time reading each other's horoscopes in the newspaper.
My name is Mark Morrissey. I work here at Bemidji State.
There are eight of us, and everyone seems to know each other, but we do a round of introductions anyway.
I'm Simone Senegals. My mother is from Red Lake, and my father is actually from Argentina.
Simone Senegals is sitting next to me, and she's really fired up about what's happening in schools, mainly because of the stories her son tells her when he comes home from his high school in Bemidji.
He was in history class, and they were reading excerpts from speeches made by lawmakers and movers and shakers throughout U.S. history. And we were talking about the need for there to be that indigenous voice in there as well, and for him to have been able to read firsthand what our people were saying, you know, during all of these different changes that were happening, and to really include that voice very intentionally into his experience.
She says she's talking with the teachers and school administrators about her concerns.
And they were like, yes, we want to figure out ways to do that. So how do we come together to really bring that in and go beyond diversity and celebrating each other to actually like challenging the power structure that makes these things happen?
How? How is a question these folks are asking a lot. How do we get people to look at hard truths? How do we move forward? How fast do we go? How hard do you push? Simone has serious concerns about this when it comes to her son's school. How hard can she rock the boat?
So in one way is you really want to rock the boat so that you can kind of create a world, you know, that's really pushing up against the things that are hurting them, you know, and you want the teachers to like them because teachers have a lot of power in the classroom. You want the teachers to like you so that they are willing to listen to you. You know, there's always that, you know, how do you rock the boat but not too much?
Anton Troyer says the same questions come up when you're dealing with injustices and law enforcement.
The data really supports that Native people are disproportionately pulled over in similar situations to their non-Native peers. Native people are disproportionately charged when they are pulled over, disproportionately tried and disproportionately convicted and disproportionately denied parole. And so we have Native people who are less than 2% of the state's population and more than 17% of the state's prison population. And that kind of disparity doesn't happen by accident.
Judy Bolio says she's seen this firsthand.
Yeah, you can't deny that there's high arrest rates here in Bemidji. If you, you know, sit down there on a bench and I invite you to do this and see who's going to court. The first time I ever moved back home and I went down there for some odd reason, probably one of my relatives was in jail, I don't know. But I seen everybody sitting on these benches and I said, where's the powwow? Because it was almost all Indian.
The group has already had a meeting with law enforcement to talk about why there are such disparities. Anton says it'll take many more conversations to come to a shared understanding. As we're sitting and talking, I notice the four white people are on one side of the table, and the three Native people are on the other. It seems like they're doing this work together, but their separation reflects a reality. Their lives are different in fundamental ways.
My name is Noreen Hautala. I grew up in northern Minnesota, surrounded by one of the highest concentrations of Native American reservations of any state in the United States, and I didn't know many Native people, and I didn't learn this stuff.
Every Native person I talked to for this story says they've heard white people say, why dig up ancient history? The past is in the past, let's leave it there. I didn't do those things. And yet the white people at this table, like Noreen, all say that knowing the real history is a key to moving forward. Noreen says through her activism in the 1980s, she finally learned the history.
About treaties and the brutality and the systematic destruction of the family system for five generations and how that impacts the community as far as loss of parenting, loss of language, loss of culture.
She says she began to understand why sometimes she felt American Indians were ambivalent towards her or even angry at her.
It gave me a language to talk with Native American people and listen to them about justifiable outrage and anger and frustration with what has happened.
She says her responsibility is to acknowledge what happened and to look at ways it's still happening.
So that I don't try to say, oh, I'm sorry, and white people could just say we're sorry and it's all good. We really need to pay attention to all the different ways that this has permeated our culture and a systemic unfairness that plays out in really subtle and really huge ways.
I really like that word, you know, like truth and reconciliation, you know, so tell truths. And I really liked what Noreen said about, you know, really being able to sit in that fire and sort of sit there and take that responsibility where you're not putting it on someone else to take care of you.
Perhaps Simone is encouraging white folks to brace themselves because she believes at some point the conversation is going to get even harder.
When we're talking about race relations between Indigenous peoples and non-Indigenous peoples, we can't just say that it's about like prejudice, but it's about land and who has the land, who has the water, how do we talk about ownership of Mother Earth, and there's a real power structure that is at the base of the inequity, and so that has to be addressed, and it gets really uncomfortable, and it challenges people, it challenges the very foundation of the country that we are in.
Nearly every person you've heard in the last half hour believes that a healing process will begin when we open a thoughtful, candid conversation about crimes committed against Native people during white colonization. And the insights from those conversations can change the way Native communities are viewed and the way our systems treat Native people. That may make some intuitive sense to you, but there's actually some science behind all this. We heard from John Gonzalez at the top of the show.
Most people are good.
He's a citizen of the White Earth Nation and a psychology professor from Bemidji State. John recently did a study with Native students at the university to look at how they respond to perceived prejudice and discrimination. Here's what he found.
The Native student who knows who they are and knows where they come from, right, and knows the history of what happened to them, they have a stronger cultural identification, and they rely on that cultural identification for strength. It's a source of resilience for them.
So identifying as a Native person and knowing what happened to your people is a way to build strength. And that's what these alliances in Bemidji are trying to do. They want to uproot the historical fiction and negative stereotypes, like they're invasive weeds in a garden. And they want to replace them with the knowledge of what really happened on this land. And then they want to watch something new and different grow. For this special edition of Minnesota Native News, I'm Melissa Townsend. Special thanks to Aaron Warhol, Diane Richard, and Marie Rock.
Minnesota Native News is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota.